Welcome to today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, April 1st. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker, and here is our first story. Will lawmakers act in time for Boy Scout abuse victims? Lawmakers face April deadline to lift Iowa's civil statute of limitations. This is an article by Tom Barton and out of Des Moines. Bill Vall fondly remembers growing up along Dubuque's bluffs. A love of the outdoors led him to join local Boy Scout Troop 23 of the Northeast Iowa Council in 1964 at the age of 11. Scouting provided opportunities for socializing and outdoor adventures, and Vall excelled, taking on leadership roles. An assistant scoutmaster, Kenny Krakow, took a liking to him and some of the other boys in the troop. Vall said Krakow would take him and a couple of other boys on outings outside the normal scouting scheduled, on camping and canoe trips to air shows and drag car and stock car races. He said Krakow often would offer to give him a ride home after scout meetings. Krakow would talk about girls, cars, Playboy magazine, and masturbation, like he was a teenager, Vall recalled. He would always make it very light and fun or entertaining, he said. We would park in front of my house and we would talk more. Krakow eventually gained Vall's trust, enough to persuade him to visit his house to look at magazines with nude girls and to race on the slot car track in his attic. Vall said he was drawn in by Krakow's charm and generosity, but now recognizes the inappropriate nature of his actions. He said Krakow sexually abused him more than a dozen times from when he was about 12 until he was 15. Vall said he never was able to tell his parents or anyone else what happened. Of course, at the time, I was unaware I was being groomed, said Vall, 71, who now lives in Tucson, Arizona. All these activities were designed to make me feel greatly indebted to him. I had a bad relationship with my own father, and so I loved the attention and we had a lot of fun. Vall said the alleged abuse went unreported until someone eventually turned in the assistant scoutmaster, whose name was included in the more than 20,000 pages of internal Boy Scouts of America documents, dubbed the Perversion Files, that detailed alleged sexual abuse by scout leaders. The files detail cases from 1959 to 1985. The records were used in a landmark 2010 court case over the abuse of six boys in a troop in Portland, Oregon, and were made public in 2012. The files detail cases, In a letter sent to the National Boy Scouts organization in December of 1970, a scout executive from the Northeast Iowa Council notified the Boy Scouts of America that Krakow, then 49, had resigned due to many years of homosexual activities with boys in the area. This fact he admitted freely to me in a conference. We have taken appropriate action here, wrote Scout Executive Max Burgoyne in a letter included in the released files. Krakow had been a volunteer with the troop since 1938 and had served as scoutmaster previously. He died in 1980. Silent for most of his 71 years, Vall is in the final stages of submitting a package of documents to the Boy Scouts of America as part of a $2.7 billion plan to give the organization a pathway out of bankruptcy while compensating tens of thousands of sex abuse victims. The Boy Scouts of America filed for bankruptcy in 2020 after several states enacted laws letting accusers sue over decades-old abuse allegations. The organization ultimately reached a settlement, approved in court in 2022, that would pay abuse victims amounts ranging from $3,500 to $2.7 million. The settlement involves more than 82,000 men who said they were abused as children by troop leaders. That fund, the largest of its kind in U.S. history to settle sexual abuse claims, distributing payments last fall to victims. But unless legislators take action this year to change Iowa law, the estimated roughly 300 to 350 Iowans involved in the settlement will receive a fraction of the awards they would be entitled to. Iowa officials in 2021 lifted the state's statute of limitations for bringing criminal charges in sexual abuse, incest, sexual exploitation, and human trafficking cases, but the law does not cover civil claims. Lawmakers face a looming deadline to lift Iowa's civil statute of limitations for filing sex abuse claims related to the Boy Scouts' bankruptcy and settlement. Iowa has 1 year from the effective date of the settlement trust, or April 19th, to change the law, or Iowa survivors will receive less than others across the country. When figuring victims' compensation, the settlement uses a matrix that weighs a variety of factors, including the type of abuse, how long it lasted, the effect it had, whether the alleged abuser had other victims, whether the victim previously knew their alleged abuser, and different states' civil statutes of limitations. Iowa's statute of limitations requires victims of child sexual abuse to file cases in district courts by the age of 19 or within 4 years of coming to the realization as an adult that their injuries and suffering are related to their alleged abuse. Gillian Dumas is an Oregon attorney who is appealing the national settlement agreement and represents an Iowan who has filed a claim in the bankruptcy. Dumas said Iowa's short statute of limitations for filing lawsuits related to child sexual abuse is a significant challenge for survivors seeking justice, as they may not be able to file until they connect their abuse to adult problems. Data from the U.S. Department of Justice suggests that 86% of child sexual abuse goes unreported altogether. When victims do report, a high percentage of them delay disclosure well into adulthood. So, in Iowa, because of that statute of limitations, the value of the claim is reduced by up to 70%, Dumas said. So, you know, a $600,000 claim would be worth only $180,000, simply because it happened in Iowa. Because his alleged abuse took place in Iowa, Vall estimates that because of how current state law figures into the settlement formula, he will receive about 30% and 40% of what he initially was entitled to as a claimant. Vall, an engineer, estimates over his lifetime he lost a couple million dollars in wages because of crippling health issues he's coped with his entire adult life. And even then, people might be paid only 5% to 10% of the value because there's not enough money in the settlement fund, Dumas said. The reason that I oppose that plan, and other survivors oppose the plan, was because it simply does not put enough money into the pot to pay them what they would if they were allowed to go forward with their own cases in state court litigation, she said. The ultimate amount paid to claimants will be determined in part by how many claims are filed and allowed, according to the Scouting Settlement Trust. Until the trust knows the total number of allowed claims, it cannot determine how much can be distributed to individual claimants, a news release states. The trustee overseeing the Boy Scouts set a May 31st deadline for all remaining claims and supporting documentation to be filed. Spokespeople for the Boy Scouts of America contacted March 25th had not answered questions as of Friday about the settlement agreement or the exact number of perpetrators and victims identified in Iowa in the bankruptcy case. Carl Bobbis, chief executive officer of the Boy Scouts of America Northeast Iowa Council, said the organization has implemented a number of protocols meant to better vet individuals put in leadership positions. We have an extremely rigorous vetting process, Bobbis said in a statement provided to the Gazette. Some of the new protocols, called barriers to abuse, include no one-on-one contact between scouts and adults and require a minimum of 2 trained leaders at every scouting function. We take the safety of the youth extremely seriously, and I applaud our national office for entering into this settlement and doing things right by the victims, Bobbis said. We believe them, and we feel their pain for their suffering. The Northeast Iowa Council includes Allamakee, Clayton, Delaware, and Dubuque counties in Iowa, and Joe Davies County in Illinois. Vall said he lived an almost normal life, but then his health deteriorated. He began experiencing crushing fatigue and muscle and joint pain that lasted decades and made it difficult to walk or stand. He said he developed headaches and was exhausted. Most days he felt like he had the flu. He worked only 2 to 3 hours a day after stopping full-time work in 1995, resulting in significant lost earnings potential. Beginning in 2008, Vall said his energy slowly began to return after he built up his strength with regular walks. I remember sitting at my desk at work thinking I felt like I had a 50-pound backpack on my back, he said. And this was not occasional. This is what it felt like every day. He said he would sleep 10 hours at night, wake up, and feel like he had slept only an hour or not at all. I did live on the edge of suicide for decades, Vall said. He went to many different doctors, including at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. None could figure out the origins of his illness. The Mayo Clinic told him to stay on bed rest for 2 years. In 2023, a psychiatrist told Vall that childhood abuse might be the root cause of his health issues and diagnosed him with a somatoform disorder, according to the psychiatrist's report, which Vall provided to the Gazette. In people with somatoform disorders, the cause is thought to be intolerable psychological conflicts that are displaced into physical complaints, the report states. For some people, trying to wrestle with physical symptoms is a much safer way to address these psychological conflicts than trying to directly confront the conflicts. Senator Janet Peterson, a Des Moines Democrat, again this year introduced a bill that would have eliminated the statute of limitation to file civil claims for sex abuse, sex trafficking, and sexual exploitation. It would create a revival window for survivors to file claims and receive 100% of damages. Senate File 2233, however, never received a subcommittee hearing and failed to clear a legislative deadline in order to remain eligible for consideration this year. The bill is supported by the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault, the Iowa Trial Lawyers Association, and League of Women Voters of Iowa. Peterson said lifting the law would allow more people to come forward and report abuse while also holding organizations accountable. Opponents expressed concerns that getting rid of the statute could make it difficult for organizations to defend themselves against decades-old cases. Brad Epperly is a lobbyist who represents Iowa's Defense Counsel Association, the only organization registered against SF 2233. Epperly said the association's opposition is not related to the Boy Scouts of America case. He said the group does not oppose eliminating the statute of limitations for perpetrators, but does oppose eliminating it for organizations and employers. If the statute of limitations was completely removed, it would be virtually impossible in some cases to defend a claim for third-party liability brought decades after the alleged occurrence, Epperly said. Dumas, the Oregon lawyer, counters that both sides bear the same burden and that victims should not be denied their right to pursue justice. States like Iowa should do everything they can to help those abused in Iowa get whatever justice they can get, she said. Not tip the scales in favor of any individual or organization that facilitated or allowed child sexual abuse on their watch. States including Alabama recently have passed laws lifting their statute of limitations for civil claims on sexual abuse to allow those abused in the Boy Scouts of America to file claims with the Scouting Settlement Trust. It's really painful, Peterson said, of frustration with lawmakers' inaction to lift the statute of limitations. The laws didn't protect them when they were children and didn't allow them to come forward as grown-ups. It's just so wrong. There still remains an opportunity this legislative session to pass a leadership or appropriations bill. Senator Tim Krayenbrink and Representative Ann Meyer, both Republicans from Fort Dodge, said they are working with leadership in both chambers to craft a bill focused specifically on allowing survivors of sexual abuse in the Boy Scouts of America to take full advantage of the bankruptcy proceedings. Meyer said she anticipated including language similar to the Alabama legislation in the standings bill, if we can get good, tight language around it. It's very disturbing, the whole story is, Meyer said. I mean, this is top-tier abuse. I think my goal for this situation is to make the legislation very narrow and very tight in confronting this particular situation, said Krayenbrink. I feel that we now have the ball rolling, he said. We have leadership aware of it, we've got the governor's office aware of it, and, you know, if there's something that we will do and we can do, then I will do everything I can to make it come to fruition. Our next article, Cedar Rapids Harrison Elementary to remain open in fall. Leaders committed to having a Northwest school. This is by Grace King out of Cedar Rapids. Students will continue to learn at Harrison Elementary School this fall, after Cedar Rapids School District officials paused a plan to demolish the historic building and build a new school on its site. At a school board meeting last week, Superintendent Tawana Grover said students at Harrison and Madison Elementary School, where the Harrison students would have attended next year while construction was underway, will stay at their respective schools next year. "We view this as being in the best interest of students and families, and we cannot confidently predict the number of transitions that might be required as it relates to the construction process," Grover said. School officials initially announced their intentions to pause the plan at a Cedar Rapids City Planning Commission meeting in January. School officials had a request to the Planning Commission submitted November 2nd of 2023 to rezone the 5.8-acre site at 1310 11th Street Northwest from traditional residential single unit to public institutional district to allow for construction of a new school after demolition of the existing structure. The city panel, however, sent the district back to firm up its plan in a unanimous vote of the 6 members present to table the district's request. "Based on our commitment to listening to feedback and the land not being rezoned at this time, we cannot go through the building process, not knowing exactly where we stand," Grover said a week ago. Principal Trista Manternick will continue to serve as principal of both Harrison and Madison Elementary Schools next year, a role she currently holds. Chad Schumacher, director of operations for Cedar Rapids Schools, said the district still is dedicated to putting a school in the Northwest neighborhood, the neighborhood where Harrison Elementary stands. "We want a school down in the area that got devastated by the 2008 flood. We know it's vital to that neighborhood for success and revitalization. We have to figure out what that school looks like," Schumacher said. The plan to raise Harrison Elementary and build a new school on its site, a decision made by the Cedar Rapids School Board almost a year ago, was mired in controversy from the start. Under the plan, Madison Elementary School at 1341 Woodside Drive Northwest would have closed and the attendance zone would be combined with Harrison by fall 2025. No decision had been made about the future of the Madison building or its land. In October of 2023, Save CR Heritage, a nonprofit dedicated to saving historic properties, submitted a petition signed by more than 500 voters in the Cedar Rapids School District. The petition required the school to place the request to reconsider the Harrison decision on its agenda in accordance with Iowa code. Some residents told the Gazette last fall they voted no on a proposed $220 million general obligation bond that went to voters in November of 2023 because they disagreed with the district's decision to tear down the historic building. The bond referendum failed with about 38% of voters in the district in favor, far short of the 60% needed to pass it. Now the school district is reassessing its facilities, bringing in architects and other experts to help come up with a future-ready plan that voters will say yes to. A new bond referendum could possibly be taken to voters in the Cedar Rapids School District in November 2025. "We heard a lot of feedback about wanting to save a historical building, and we were concerned we made a decision that was rushed and a decision that would have an impact on our future success of funding our facilities," Schumacher said. "We wanted to make sure we heard that community clearly and completely," Schumacher said. "I hope people hear the genuine, we want to hear what they have to say. It's not a rouse, and hopefully they understand we have to make some tough decisions. We can't keep all of our buildings at the status quo they are now and be fiscally responsible." Okay, I'm going to turn to the Iowa Today section and the government notes. Cedar Rapids City Council signs off on UTV ban. Also, Iowa City is asking for residents' input on the future of a downtown property. The Cedar Rapids City Council last week gave final approval to a ban on utility task vehicles, or UTVs, on streets inside the city of Cedar Rapids. Under the new Cedar Rapids ordinance, which is now in effect, all-terrain vehicles, off-road utility vehicles, golf carts, and snowmobiles are not allowed to operate on city streets, right-of-ways, and other public property. A state law enacted in 2022 allowed cities to regulate usage of the vehicles. There are exceptions allowing use of the vehicles for survey by a licensed engineer or land survey, by emergency personnel, or by a governmental entity or political subdivision in the course of employment duties, such as Park Cedar Rapids Work downtown. Private properties could use them for snow removal on their sidewalks and driveway aprons. A licensed business also could use them for landscaping, maintenance, and snow removal, but the vehicles would need to be taken by trailer to the location where work is contracted. Allowable uses of a snowmobile under Iowa code also would be permitted, such as upon city highways that have not been plowed during the snow season. Those who violate the ordinance would be penalized with a traffic citation. According to the city, total fines and court costs would be $135.50 for ATV, UTVs, and snowmobiles, $210.25 for golf carts. Rough Riders honor retired Cedar Rapids Police Chief. Recently retired Cedar Rapids Police Chief Wayne German was honored in March as the Geico Philanthropic Difference Maker for the Year at a Cedar Rapids Rough Riders hockey game. German's career in law enforcement began in 1974 when he started as a dispatcher for the Montgomery County, Maryland Police Department. In 2012, he came to Cedar Rapids, where he was sworn in as the city's 43rd police chief. He retired last April after he aged out of his certification when he turned 66 years old in March of 2023. His accomplishments included the creation of the Police Community Action Team, a specialized unit with an emphasis on community and neighborhood issues, as well as the Police Chiefs Advisory Committee. He led the establishment of a partnership with the National Alliance on Mental Illness to provide training and assistance to officers through the Crisis Intervention Team, which responds to incidents involving mental health crises. In 2022, the Iowa Police Chiefs Association named German the Law Enforcement Executive of the Year. At the hockey game, he was presented with a personalized Rough Riders jersey and rode on a Zamboni as a thanks for his service to the community. Iowa City seeks input on lot redevelopment. The City of Iowa City is seeking community input on the redevelopment of a vacant city-owned lot at 21 South Lynn Street. The city purchased the property for $4.5 million in July of 2023. The property formerly housed a U.S. Bank drive-thru. It also was the site of City Hall, which was demolished in 1962. Through the acquisition of 21 South Lynn, we can work to identify the exact uses that we would like to see on that property, City Manager Jeff Froon said at the time of the purchase. We can identify some high-level goals and partner with the private sector to develop that in a way that's going to add some long-term stability and vibrancy to downtown Iowa City. Residents are invited to share their experiences in the downtown area and their thoughts on the redevelopment project, which is targeted as a mixed-use development and public-private partnership. The city is offering several options for residents to submit feedback. You can do an online survey at icgov.org/21LINN. It's available in English, Spanish, French, Arabic, and Mandarin. Or you can email comments in their preferred language to publicinput@iowa-city.org. Or finally, you can make written comments that can be mailed or dropped off to City Hall in care of Economic Development, 410 East Washington Street, Iowa City, Iowa, 52240. There are also open house sessions. You can drop in on an open house input session anytime between 6 and 7:30 p.m. on Monday, April 15th, at the Iowa City Public Library, Meeting Room A, or Tuesday, April 23rd, at the Pheasant Ridge Neighborhood Center. In partnership with the Iowa City Downtown District, downtown visitors and pedestrians in the area of 21 South Lynn also can text hello, 21 S Lynn, to 319-346-3443 to share their thoughts on the proposed project. Residents are asked to submit feedback using one option by May 1st. Resident feedback will be used to help the city understand what type of building uses and benefits are needed to meet the needs and desires of the community. Cedar Rapids Mayor to deliver State of the City Address May 23rd. Cedar Rapids Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell will present the State of the City Address at noon, May 23rd, at the DoubleTree by Hilton Hotel, Cedar Rapids Convention Center, in the Exhibit Hall, at 350 First Avenue Northeast. The event will be hosted by the City of Cedar Rapids. Doors open at 11 a.m. Lunch service begins at 11:30 a.m. O'Donnell's State of the City Address starts at noon. Seating is available on a first-come, first-served basis. Luncheon reservations cost $75 per individual and $750 for a table of 10. Visit cityofcr.com/SOTC for more information and to reserve a table. A limited number of free reserve seats are available upon request by emailing communications@cedar-rapids.com. A recording will be available for viewing online after the event. Accessible parking is available in the Convention Center parking ramp at 361 First Avenue Southeast. Anyone who requires an auxiliary aid or service for effective communication or a modification of procedures to participate should contact Rachel McCracken at 319-286-5148 or email r.mccracken@cedar-rapids.org as soon as possible, but no later than 48 hours before the scheduled event. TTY users may also call 711, the Iowa Relay Service. Okay, I'm going to turn to the insight section, the community letters to the editor. We have two today. Our first one is from Ann Fields of Lansing. Millions of Americans gained health care under ACA. Happy 14th birthday to the Affordable Care Act. The ACA was signed into law in March of 2010 and provides reasonable health insurance for more than 21 million people. Another 24 million people gained health care coverage through ACA's Medicaid expansion. What does the ACA mean for Iowans? Some 83,000 Iowans now have health care through ACA, and another 245,000 Iowans are enrolled in Medicaid expansion coverage. Approximately 1 in 11 Iowans have ACA or the Medicaid expansion programs. According to Women in Iowa, as of 2023, 32% of single mothers with kids live in poverty and depend on the ACA and Medicaid expansion. Because of the ACA, women can no longer be charged more than men for the same coverage. Maternity care is covered and postpartum care is being expanded to 12 months. The ACA keeps women and children healthy and in school. Without affordable health insurance, women and children fail to get needed care, end up in emergency rooms, and are not able to pay their medical bills. Not a single Republican voted for the American Care Act, and many Republicans have tried to overturn it, which could throw thousands of families into a state of no health insurance. The former president said he will cut the ACA if elected, leaving thousands of Iowans without adequate medical insurance. The Democrats have protected Iowans by lowering prescription drug and insurance costs. Hooray to the Democrats who passed the ACA 14 years ago and will continue to provide for reasonable health care insurance. Again, that was from Ann Fields of Lansing. And our last letter is from Kurt Zingela of Central City. Article falsely implies farmers are causing cancer. It's increasingly necessary to fact-check the media. Case in point is a report from Gazette reporter Aaron Jordan about farmers allegedly contributing to Iowa's second-in-the-nation cancer rate. Jordan implies that farmers have a higher rate of prostate cancer than the general population due to exposure to pesticides and fertilizer. Jordan failed to mention that prostate cancer increases substantially with age. The average age of farmers is 58, while the average age of all Iowans is 38. Jordan fearmongers nitrates as a cause of blue baby syndrome, but failed to mention that blue baby hasn't occurred in Iowa for half a century. Jordan failed to report that 80% of the nitrates people consume comes from food, mostly leafy greens and other vegetables we're encouraged to eat more of. A trick of the trade that Jordan used was to quote one farmer who identifies with an agenda as if he represents the entire farming community. Jordan repeatedly cited studies using correlations, correlation significantly lacks the respect of causation, actual effect, within the science community. However, going out on that limb, we see that Corn Belt State Illinois is ranked 20th in the nation for cancer occurrence, and another Corn Belt state, Indiana, is ranked 43rd. To demonize farmers for what amounts to involuntary manslaughter is unacceptable. And that again was from Kurt Zingula of Central City. You are listening to the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please call us at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Lorena Fern Carr, K-A-R-R, of Centerpoint, was 96 when she died Thursday, March 28th, at Virginia Gay Hospital in Vinton. There will be a private family graveside service at Urbana Memorial Cemetery. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Jesse Paul Dewar of Austin, Texas, was 39. He was formerly of West Branch and Iowa City. Left his body on February 5th in the loving company of his family. Jesse will be remembered for his kind and generous heart and infectious laughter. He was a passionate musician, bike mechanic, and visual artist, and a talented chef working in many restaurants in New York City, Iowa City, and Austin. He attended West Branch Friends Meeting and more recently Austin Friends Meeting. His memory will be cherished by his father, David Dewar of Iowa City, his brother and sister-in-law, Sierra Soleil and Tina Yin of Seattle, Washington. His sister and nephews, Emma, Oscar, and Linus Dewar of Roanoke, Virginia, and his partner and soulmate, Lilia Leslie of Berlin, Germany. I think that's probably Liesl. Lilia Liesl of Berlin, Germany. He was preceded in death by his mother, Patricia Dewar. In lieu of flowers, donations may be given in his name to Shelter House and the Iowa City Bike Library. A celebration of Jesse's life will be held on June 8th from 1 to 4 p.m. at Old Brick in Iowa City. Stanley Arthur Raymer, 74, of Cedar Rapids, died at his home on February 10th. He was born on February 28, 1949, in Waconia, Minnesota. He is survived by his three children, Melissa, Mikhail, and Charlene, and granddaughter, Taylor, and his siblings, Earl, Robert, and Betty. No memorial service will be held. Oscar Lee Brownstein, nicknamed Oki, was 95 when he died on March 29th from complications from a fall in his neighborhood. He was also known by family and friends in Israel by his Hebrew name, Asher Lev Ben-Haim. Oki was born November 13, 1928, in Becko, West Virginia, to Haim and Thelma Brownstein. He graduated from Charleston High School, attended the University of West Virginia, but flunked out because he was too busy editing the humor magazine and playing bridge for money. He was drafted into the Army and served as a field artillery specialist in the Korean War. Returning to the States, he attended college on the GI Bill, earning a BA and an MA in English from the University of Missouri before going on to earn an MFA in playwriting from the Yale School of Drama and a PhD in theater from the University of Iowa. He taught English for 3 years at Binghamton College, State University of New York, SUNY, before being invited to return to the University of Iowa as a theater professor. At Iowa, he taught dramatic literature and theater history before becoming director of the newly formed Iowa Playwrights Workshop, which at the time was also considered a part of the Iowa Writers Workshop. In 1979, he left Iowa to become the chair of the playwriting department at the Yale School of Drama, where he taught for 10 years before retiring. During the 1984-85 academic year, he took a leave of absence and moved to Israel with his second wife, teaching dramatic literature at Hebrew University and Tel Aviv University. Over the years, Oki heard from many of his students, especially his playwrights, who thanked him for inspiring their creative work. He also viewed his primary role as creating the right conditions in which playwrights could thrive and learn to develop their unique voices in the process of revising their scripts. Though highly accomplished professionally, when asked what he was most proud of in his life, Oki quickly replied without pause, "My three children." He adored his children and grandchildren and always felt intensely happy in their presence. Oki is survived by his wife, Daphna Benheim, his three children, David Brownstein, B.J. Schmidt, Sherry, spouse Jeff Hall, and Jonathan, spouse Angela Brownstein, and four grandchildren, Ethan, significant other Sam Dorhoff, Gabriel Bonet, Dylan Brownstein, and Alexander Brownstein. He is also survived by his sister Ruth Leibowitz and his sister-in-law Marilyn Brownstein. He was predeceased by his parents, his younger brother Sam, and his ex-wife and the mother of his children, Suzanne Brooks Brownstein. A memorial service is scheduled for Sunday, June 16th at 1 p.m. at Lensing's Oak Hill Chapel, 210 Holiday Road, Coralville. Oki was a highly creative, brilliant man who wore his intelligence lightly. He was always a quiet, modest person with a dry wit and a passionate interest in many things in life. He had one of the most positive perspectives about life of anyone who ever lived. Okay, we're going to turn to the sports section. Events of area interest today. There's girls soccer, Dubuque Senior at Washington at 7:30 p.m., Northeast at Regina at 5 p.m., Marion at South Tama at 5:30 p.m., boys soccer, Linmar at Jefferson at 4:15 p.m., Prairie at Linmar at 4:15 p.m., Washington at City High at 4:15 p.m., Kennedy at Iowa City West at 5:45 p.m., Washington at Dubuque Senior at 7:15 p.m., Prince of Peace at Regina at 6:30 p.m., and Marion at South Tama at 7 p.m. We've got some college softball, Drake at Iowa at 5 p.m., UNI at Iowa State at 4 p.m., Cornell at Grinnell at 1 p.m. And on television today, we of course have the NCAA tournament with Iowa versus LSU at 6 p.m. on ESPN. That's women's NCAA tournament. We also have USC versus Connecticut at 8 p.m. on ESPN, and WBI Penn State versus Villanova at 1:30 p.m. on ESPNU. Illinois versus Washington State at 4 p.m. on ESPNU. And the NJCAA Championship at 7 p.m. on ESPNU. Major League Baseball today, Rockies at the Cubs at 1 p.m. And the Braves, that's on Marquee Channel. Braves are at White Sox at 1 p.m. on NBCS Chicago. And the Rangers at the Rays, 5:30 p.m. on FS1. In the NBA, Suns at the Pelicans, 7 p.m. on NBA TV. Hawks at Bulls at 7 p.m. on NBCS Chicago. And on the radio, you can catch the NCAA tournament at 6 p.m. on KGYM. And the Rockies at the Cubs at 1 p.m. on KXIC. And, so many of our articles are about the upcoming game tonight. I'm just going to read a brief on that, a closer look at tonight's game. Number 2 ranked Iowa, whose record is 32-4, versus number 8 LSU, whose record is 31-5. This is the basketball tournament, the NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament Regional Final. It is taking place in Albany, New York at the MVP Arena. Tip-off is at 6 p.m. on ESPN, as I mentioned, and you can also live stream it on ESPN.com or ESPN or the ESPN app. The Hawkeye Radio Network affiliates will be airing it. And Iowa's next game, if they win, they'll be playing number 3 USC, whose record is 29-5, or number 10 Connecticut, whose record is 32-5, in the Final Four on Friday in Cleveland. What to know? Iowa is a 1.5-point favorite to avenge its loss to LSU in last year's NCAA championship game. The Hawkeyes breezed past number 17 Colorado in Saturday's regional semifinal, 89-68. Caitlin Clark registered 29 points and 15 assists, and all four of the other starters reached double figures. LSU pulled away with a 14-2 run at the end of the game to advance 78-69 over number 6 UCLA. Flajae Johnson led the Tigers with 24 points and 12 rebounds. Iowa is making its sixth Elite Eight appearance, its fourth since 2015, its second consecutive. It's the 11th Elite Eight run for LSU. All five of LSU's starters average in double figures, led by junior Angel Reese, with 18.6 points per game. Junior Anissa Morrow, 16.5 points per game, played at DePaul last year. Fifth-year senior Haley Van Lith, who averages 11.7 points per game, was on Louisville's Elite Eight team. LSU coach Kim Mulkey ended Iowa's deep postseason runs while at Baylor in 2015. Sweet 16 was Oklahoma City. In 2019, the Elite Eight at Greensboro, North Carolina, then beat the Hawkeyes in the final last year in Dallas. Mulkey owns a 91-13 record in 3 years at LSU. Iowa is number one in the nation in scoring offense at 91.9 points per game. LSU is number three with 85.9 points per game. Clark has scored 3,859 career points, which is the most in women's basketball history. And that was a little brief look at tonight's game by Jeff Linder. All right, let's turn to men's basketball. Edie sends Purdue to first Final Four since 80. Boilermakers stopped Tennessee 72-66 in Elite Eight matchup out of Detroit. By the time all the scrapping and scratching and diving on the floor was over, it felt like a shame both those teams and both those players weren't moving on to the Final Four. Just don't expect Purdue to feel bad about it. Boilermakers big man Zach Eddy went for a career-high 40 points Sunday to muscle Purdue within two wins of the title for the first time since 1980 with a 72-66 victory over Dalton Knecht and his never-say-quit Tennessee teammates. The 7'4" Eddy and a unanimous AP All-American didn't even need a ladder to cut down the net after edging out Knecht, another All-American, who had 37 points. The game's top two players and their teams went back and forth all day. How close was it? With 5 points left and the score tied at 58, both players had scored 31 points on 12 field goals. According to OptiStats, this was the first time opposing players scored more than half their squad's points in an NCAA tournament game. You're not trying to take away 100%, you're trying to take away maybe 80% of what he's trying to get accomplished, Purdue coach Matt Painter said of Knecht. But we don't take Zach for granted. He could have scored 50 tonight if he'd made his free throws. Eddie missed 8 of his 22 attempts from the foul line. One of those misses sparked the play of the game. After Tennessee grabbed the rebound and worked the ball down court, Eddie swatted away Knecht's layup as he drove to the basket while trailing by 5 with 33 seconds left. It was Eddie's only block on the day, and it put an end to the Vols' desperate comeback hopes. I was just trying to get back and make my presence felt on the defensive end of the court and make up for it, Eddie said. Top-seeded Purdue, whose record is 33-4, set aside last year's grand disappointment, a first-round loss as a number one seed, to book the trip to Glendale, Arizona. On Saturday, the Boilermakers will play North Carolina State in the national semifinals. We had to take it, Painter said, of the abuse that came last year. Sometimes when you sit in it and you're honest with yourself and you take it, some great things can happen. Tennessee, whose record is 27-9, a number two seed, was seeking its first Final Four, and Vols coach Rick Barnes was denied the second trip of his 38-year career to college basketball's promised land. I think I will read one more article here about the Iowa women's basketball. As Iowa advances, Affalter continues to shine. Hard-nosed, versatile junior has been one of the most valuable Hawkeyes during this postseason run. Out of Albany, New York, if a transfer portal exit ever crossed Sydney Affalter's mind, it didn't stay there long. I just focused on my game, the rugged do-it-all junior said Sunday. I made a commitment when I was a junior in high school, and I was going to keep it. When opportunity, big opportunity, finally knocked, Affalter was ready, more than ready. It's what we all want in life, to get a shot, Iowa assistant coach Jan Jensen said. Iowa lost Molly Davis, perhaps for the remainder of the season, to a knee injury in the regular season women's basketball finale against Ohio State on March 3rd. enter Affalter, and the second-ranked Hawkeyes, whose record is 32-4, have kept humming along. They'll face number 8 LSU, whose record is 31-5, in an NCAA tournament regional final at 6 p.m. today at MVP Arena. All year long, I was telling her, "You're the sixth player in the Big Ten," Iowa coach Lisa Bluter said. She could be starting on every other team. I love what she said one time. She said a lot of people transfer when they're not getting the starting position or when they're not getting their playing time, and they jump to where they think the grass is going to be greener. She said, "I stuck with it because I love this place." Affalter has started in the Hawkeyes' last 6 games, and she has blossomed into one of the team's most impactful players. During that span, 3 in the Big Ten tournament, she was an all-tournament pick, and 3 in the NCAA. Affalter is averaging 13 points and 7.7 rebounds per game. She is shooting 58.1% from the field, 95.5% from the free throw line. "She's been so good for us, and I'm just so proud of her because she played behind 2 really good players in Katie and McKenna Warnock to start her career. She never really got many minutes," Caitlin Clark said. "For her, this year is kind of take a step and really make this moment hers has been really fun to watch. Nobody deserves it more than her. More than anything, you're just happy for her. Versatility helps. She just seamlessly went into the starting lineup, and I think it's because of the style that we play," Bluter said. "We're kind of positionless, so it really doesn't matter. If you're 1, 2, 3, or 4, it doesn't really matter. They all do the same things. Affalter can play any of those positions effectively. She's a guard or a forward. She's a ball player. She's a stud," Kate Martin said. All right, a few national notes here. Yeager gets first PGA Tour title. Out of Houston, Stephen Yeager won his first PGA Tour event in his 135th attempt, closing with 9 straight pars for a 3-under 67 and avoiding a playoff when Scottie Scheffler missed a 5-foot birdie putt on the final hole Sunday. Scheffler was trying to become the first player in 7 years to win 3 straight starts on the PGA Tour, and he was right there with a chance. He 2-putted for birdie from 20 feet on the par 5 16th and missed from 12 feet for a birdie on the 17th. His 5-foot birdie putt to force a playoff missed to the left, and Scheffler had to settle for a 68 and a runner-up finish. Korad wins third straight on LPGA. Out of Gilbert, Arizona, top-ranked Nelly Korda became the first LPGA Tour player in 8 years to win 3 straight starts, closing with a 7-under 65 on a soggy Sunday for a 2-shot victory in the Ford Championship. Korda won the Drive-On Championship in her hometown of Bradenton, Florida, before sitting out all of the LPGA's Asian Swing. She returned and won the Fur Hill Seripac Championship in a playoff last week in California to move back to number 1 in the women's world ranking. Australian rookie Hira Navid shot 66 and finished alone in second. Goosen saves par in champions win. Out of Rancho Mirage, California, Retief Goosen hit into the water on the par 5 18th hole and saved par to win the Galleria Classic with a 3-under 69 with plenty of help from the blunders of Stephen Alker. Goosen and Alker were tied for the lead going to the final hole at Mission Hills. Goosen was on the edge of a bunker and hit a 4-iron so thin it splashed twice in the water that surrounds the 18th green on the Dynashore tournament course. Instead of laying up, Alker also chose to go for the green. His 5-iron narrowly cleared the pond but bounced back into the water. He pitched onto the green and missed his par putt. And our final little short article, SMU closing in on USC's Enfield out of Dallas. SMU is close to hiring Southern California basketball coach Andy Ellen Enfield to take over the Mustangs, a person familiar with the situation said Monday. They are moving next season into the basketball-rich Atlantic Coast Conference. Enfield could be named SMU's coach within a few days, according to the person who spoke to the Associated Press, on condition of anonymity because a deal had not been finalized. The Trojans were 15-18 this season with a Bronny James as a freshman, ending a run of 4 consecutive years winning more than 20 games. Enfield is 220 and 147 in 11 years at USC. All right, we're going to turn to some other articles here before we finish today. I'm going to go back to the government notes and finish up. We just had a couple of those left. Cedar Rapids Mayor. Oh, we did that one. Sorry. CCA receiving Carrie Chapman Cat Award today. Clear Creek Amana High School will be presented with the Carrie Chapman Cat Award today from Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate. The award goes to any school that registers at least 90% of eligible students to vote. The high school registered 94% of eligible senior students to vote. They are one of 126 high schools in Iowa who have signed up to participate in the program, and one of 39 high schools who have met the requirements to receive the award. This is the high school's first year receiving the award. The Carrie Chapman Cat Award is named after the famous Iowan who was instrumental in securing the passage of the 19th Amendment, granting women access to the ballot box 100 years ago. Also at CCA, Clear Creek Amana High School's Dean of Students Ryan Paulson was named the first principal of the school district's new elementary school, East Ridge Elementary. The school is located on 30 acres of land west of Coral Ridge Avenue and east of the intersection of Interstate 380 and Highway 6 in Coralville. I am eager to begin my work as principal of East Ridge Elementary, where I will be working with an amazing instructional staff moving from Oak Hill Elementary with a history of consistent classroom success, Paulson said in a news release. I am most excited about working with our students and developing the next generation of school and community leaders. Before coming to the Clear Creek Amana Community School District 4 years ago, Paulson was a high school social studies teacher in the Waterloo Community School District. His wife, Joanna, is an English language learner teacher in the Clear Creek Amana School District, and they have two daughters in the district. And Cedar Rapids Freedom Festival announces 2024 lineup. Dock Dogs, Balloon Glow, Fireworks among signature events. This article is by Diana Nolan out of Cedar Rapids. Balloons will glow, dogs will leap off docks, cardboard boats will sink or swim, fireworks will light up the night sky, and heroes will be honored during the 2024 Cedar Rapids Freedom Festival running June 8th to July 4th. With an array of activities for all ages, the event will celebrate community, patriotism, and freedom. Highlights include the return of the Cardboard Boat Regatta on June 8th at Robbins Lake in Ellis Park, the tribute to Heroes Breakfast at Veterans Memorial Building on June 14th, the Army Band performing in Marion's Low Park on Father's Day, June 16th, the Freedom Bike Ride on June 23rd, beginning and ending in Eli's City Park, the popular Dock Dogs making waves the weekend of June 28th, and the Grand Parade marching through downtown Cedar Rapids on June 29th. Balloon Glow festivities are expanding on June 22nd at Jones Park. Festivities will kick off at noon with the return of the Bohemian Betty Flea Market in the park until 9 p.m. The Eastern Iowa Arts Academy is bringing the Volta Youth Music and Arts Festival to the Balloon Glow stage at 1 p.m. with Des Moines cover band Birdchild headlining at 7 p.m. The July 4th grand finale features a 7 p.m. concert by Elizabeth Von Presley at the McCrath Amphitheater, followed by the Downtown Fireworks Extravaganza. We are immensely excited about the festival's upcoming endeavors, said Marnie Schultz, the festival's events and marketing director. Our collaborative efforts with various area nonprofits aim to foster stronger community bonds and support shared causes. Additionally, we're extending our reach into neighboring towns surrounding Cedar Rapids, promising an even more inclusive and expansive celebration of freedom and community spirit. For the full events list, go to freedomfestival.com or email info@freedomfestival.com. Okay, and solar eclipse path across U.S. On April 8th, parts of the United States will experience a total solar eclipse. The rest of the continental U.S. will be able to see a partial eclipse. A total solar eclipse will cross North America on Monday, April 8th, briefly turning day into dusk along a path through Mexico, the United States, and Canada. Totality will last up to 4 minutes, 28 seconds in certain spots, twice as long as the full solar eclipse that darkened U.S. skies in 2017. There won't be another coast-to-coast eclipse in the U.S. until 2045. The first location in continental North America that will experience totality is Mexico's Pacific Coast around 2:07 p.m. the, and that's Eastern time, the eclipse will exit continental North America on the Atlantic coast of Canada at 3:46 p.m. Eastern time. So here's a related article. Birds, bees, plants might act weird during eclipse. A total eclipse isn't just a spectacle in the sky. When the moon consumes the sun on April 8th, day will plunge into twilight. The temperature will drop, and nature will take notice. Reports abound of unusual animal and plant behavior during eclipses. A swarm of ants carrying food froze until the sun reemerged during an 1851 eclipse in Sweden. Sap flowed more slowly in a 75-year-old beech tree in Belgium in 1999. Orb-weaving spiders started tearing down their webs, and North American side-blotched lizards closed their eyes during an eclipse in Mexico in 1991. Plenty of scientists see eclipses as rare opportunities to bolster anecdotal reports by studying how nature responds, or doesn't, to a few minutes of dusk in the middle of the day. That's why teams across the country produced a swarm of studies about plant and animal behavior during the last total eclipse to cut across the United States in 2017. Some of these scientists found that when the sun vanished, insects, birds, and plants seemed to enter into something approaching a nocturnal pattern. Case in point, scientists in multiple states reported that fireflies started flashing, and a team in Idaho captured two species of voles that are normally active at night. Bat researchers in Georgia, on the other hand, weren't convinced that the eclipse had any effect on the behavior, though they noticed slightly more bat activity on the night after the eclipse than on previous or subsequent nights. Understanding how eclipses affect nature, writ largely, is nearly impossible. That's because eclipses don't follow one of the most basic rules of science, replication. They don't happen with regularity in the same spot. They vary in length. They happen at different times of day, during different seasons. A lot of things we found in the literature were exactly that, a curiosity. It happens once every so often, so it's curious, but not generally informative of animal behavior, said Olav Ruppel, a scientist who studies honeybee biology at the University of Alberta in Canada. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.